Beirut. A Muslim group in Lebanon claims it has killed kidnapped British journalist Alec Collett. The Revolutionary Organization of Socialist Muslims has released a videotape showing a man dangling from a scaffold. The tape was provided to the independent Beirut newspaper An-Nahar, along with a typewritten Arabic statement saying the 64-year-old Collett was executed April 16th in retaliation for Britain's support of the U.S. air raid on Libya. For more on that story, stay tuned this evening at 5 o'clock to All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Well, with me now on Fresh Air is journalist Nat Hentoff, who has devoted most of his writing to the subjects of jazz and civil liberties. But in a speech to students at his alma mater, Northwestern University, he said his primary profession is being a troublemaker. As he describes in his new memoir, he got off to an early start in that pursuit when, as a kid, he deliberately ate a salami sandwich outside of his synagogue on Yom Kippur, which is a Jewish High Holy Day during which you fast. Now the trouble he stirs up is more political. He writes a Village Voice column, which is usually devoted to First Amendment and civil liberties issues. He's a staunch free speech advocate and an independent thinker whose stance sometimes surprised the liberal and Jewish communities. Many feminists were shocked when he wrote in opposition to abortion. A fringe group of rabbis excommunicated him after he came out against Israel's invasion of Lebanon. Nat Hentoff's interest in jazz goes back to growing up in Boston and going to school in Chicago, when he started collecting records and hanging out in clubs. The jazz musicians he met then, he says, were his chief rabbis. After hosting a jazz radio show in Boston for 10 years, he became the New York editor of Downbeat magazine. Then he co-founded the groundbreaking journal of jazz criticism, Jazz Review. He's produced jazz records by many great musicians, including Charles Mingus, Cecil Taylor, and Pee Wee Russell. He continues to write about jazz and is also the author of several books about jazz, as well as on civil liberties. His new book is a memoir about growing up in Boston and Chicago, and it's called Boston Boy. Boston Boy is published by Knopf. Nat Hentoff, welcome to Fresh Air.
It's a privilege to be here because I listen to Fresh Air, and I think this is the class radio interview series.
Thank you very much. Did you ever think you'd write a memoir about yourself? Had you ever planned on doing that?
Vaguely, but never to the specifics of actually starting to write. And I doubt if this would have been written had not Robert Gottlieb, the publisher and editor-in-chief of Knopf, and who was the best editor in all of bookdom, had he not, though he is a man of great patience, come to me after 10 years and said, look, the contract is here, the manuscript is not here. If you don't write it, you're going to have to return the advance. Now, I don't know any writer who ever has the advance more than a couple of days after he gets it. So I had no choice but to try to write the book. And I'm very grateful to him. If I hadn't dedicated the book to Francis Sweeney, I would have dedicated it to him, because without him there literally would have been no memoir.
What did you do to jog your memory when you were going back to your youth?
I do in any kind of writing that has to do with journalism, although this didn't, I looked for the lead, because if I get the right lead, then it's not that everything flows thereafter without any problems, but at least they begin to flow. And my lead here was those three rabbis. I had read a story in the Washington Post that three rabbis, circuit-riding rabbis, I don't know if they had any regular congregations at all, had holed up in a motel in a small town in Massachusetts and decided to, I think using a 17th century Prague recipe for excommunication, had decided to read out of the Jewish community all of those Jews who had signed an ad protesting the invasion of Lebanon. And as they read out each name, they snuffed a candle out. That meant that that person was no longer a Jew and therefore really no longer in existence so far as it mattered. And I thought about that, and I immediately began to get pictures of my own neighborhood in Roxbury in the 30s and 40s, which was a very Orthodox neighborhood for the most part, aside from the anarchists and the socialists and the communists. But the basic thrust was the synagogues had very important places. And these were rabbis, though, out of another time and a whole other way of thinking. They never would have excommunicated us, but I began to try to figure out who they were in contrast to these rather pathetic people. And then other images came to mind, and I said, okay, now I know where I am. I'm back there, thanks to those three rabbis who tried to excommunicate me, and I was able to start.
You grew up in a predominantly Jewish neighborhood, and your parents seemed to really try to instill in you a sense of us and them, the Jewish people and everybody else you weren't supposed to really be friends with or hang out with.
Well, that was mostly my mother. My father was a traveling salesman, and beside that, before that, he had been in the Army. But he was fairly urbane. He went to all kinds of cities. He traveled in the South and all through New England. And he had less of a sense than my mother that all Gentiles were anti-Semitic and that therefore they were to be kept away from. My mother, though, did believe, as many men and women in that neighborhood, that anti-Semitism was as close as the first Gentile you met in the first hour of the day you went out on the street. They weren't entirely wrong in Boston at the time because it turned out to be the most anti-Semitic city in the country. But they did feel that part of their mission as parents was to protect their young, as all parents feel, from hurt, from harm. And the way to do that, they felt, and again, this is my mother rather than my father, was to instill in the young a profound suspicion of Gentiles. You can never trust them, my mother would say. And to instill the sense that your only protection was solidarity with other Jews.
How did you react to that? Is that something you tried to follow in your early years?
No, because I was a reader. I was an obsessive reader. To me, one of the great pleasures of the week was going to the public library and trying to con the librarian into letting me take out more than the two books I was allowed. And I read fairy tales. I read fiction. So I knew from reading that this insularity, first of all, was not unique to Jews. It happened everywhere else, and it didn't work. And it didn't make any sense that if you were to make your way in the world, in a sense, you had to view everybody with suspicion until he or she proved himself or herself. But to lock yourself into that kind of self-encapsulation was to deprive yourself of something. You never knew what you were depriving yourself because you never let yourself get to know anybody except Jews.
You said that there were some realistic fears in Boston about anti-Semitism and that it was one of the more anti-Semitic cities in the country.
It was the most anti-Semitic city in the country.
What made it that way?
Well, that's an interesting question because I've been back to my old neighborhood three or four times recently and around Boston as a whole. And I've thought more and more about this than I ever have before, and I've tried out my feelings on a lot of people. You know, when you go back to the anti-Catholicism that was rampant in this country in the late 19th century and early 20th, Boston was worse than any other city, except maybe Philadelphia, where they burned down some Catholic schools. And there are Irish people who are old now who remember the signs on quality lodging houses in Boston, no Irish or dogs. Then came the 30s and early 40s, and there were people, I can think of one of them by name, John Roy Carlson, a very good journalist, who did a book called Undercover. And he was investigating extremist hate groups around the country. And he came to the conclusion that Boston was the most extreme anti-Semitic city in the country. Then after that came the period of racism, anti-black feeling. And Tony Lucas, in his very good book, Common Ground, which has to do with the attempt, unsuccessful by and large, to desegregate Boston schools. Tony makes the point that a lot of this was class rather than race, and that's quite true. But he underestimates, I think, the intensity of the racial feeling. That's now being visited upon Asians who live in Boston and who move into the wrong neighborhoods. And just a couple of weeks ago, I ran into a young woman who is white, who recently moved into the North End, and that's at the Italian stronghold of Boston. And she was asked by the landlady, "Do you have a black boyfriend?" And she said, "No." "Okay," said the landlady, "because if you did, I couldn't rent you this apartment. You got to remember, you're not at home. This is not your home." Then she and a friend, also white, were walking along the street near her apartment in the North End a couple of days later, and all of a sudden they were surrounded by some Italian youngsters who started to stone them, real stones. And the woman said to me, "Do you know what they were yelling at us as they were throwing the stones? You're damn liberals." Now, I don't think there's another place in the United States, not that bigotry is limited only to Boston, where you'd get kids saying that. What they were saying was, "You are strangers. Therefore, there is something about you that is going to contaminate our neighborhood, and you should get out of this neighborhood. And the theory is, one theory is, that Boston is more like this than other cities because there are so many different kinds of enclaves of what Jimmy Carter once called and later regretted calling ethnic purity. And those enclaves are so geographically self-enclosed that you really do only get to know only people just like you as you're growing up. And if you don't have the kind of a job or education that gets you past those barriers, then you're very much like the Jews who were in the ghettos in the Middle Ages. And that leads, I think, to this excess of territoriality that characterizes Boston.
You were actually beaten up during your youth a couple of times, and I think at least once it had to do with being Jewish. But from reading your memoir, it seems that you were never really much of a fighter. Did that trouble you when you were young?
Oh, sure.
You couldn't really fight?
Ronald Reagan and I saw the same movies when we were growing up. And the heroes were people like Clark Gable in that movie San Francisco, or John Wayne, who started to come along then. The American, not only the American, but at least the clear model was of the man who would not take, forget somebody punching him in the nose, who would not take a slight, a verbal slight without punching the other guy in the nose and then stomping on him. Well, there was not that much of a bellicose tradition among most Jewish lads at the time. We had one tough guy in our neighborhood. It's interesting. I never thought about it till years later. He was the only guy who was beaten by his mother regularly. And so his notion of how to be in the world was to go and beat up other people. But other than him and a legendary professional boxer that I wrote about in the book, Mickey Cohen, the rest of us were not what you would call vigorous or voluntary combatants. And the other kids knew that, so they gave them all the more pleasure.
There's all these memoirs where someone who can't fight gets picked on, and then they really rise to the occasion, and no one ever threatens them again. I guess
that's like
never
the old Charles
Atlas
ads, where you're too young to remember of the guy who was sitting on the beach with his girlfriend. He's very spindly, and this big bully throws sand in his face, but then he takes the bodybuilding exercises, and he kicks the bully halfway across to Portugal, across the ocean. No, it didn't work that way. I got my vicarious pleasure out of this one boxer, Mickey Cohen, who was slouched against a liquor store window, not that he drank, one evening when a bunch of Irish kids came in, and maybe they were inspired by newsreels of Hitler Germany, but they were pushing old people into the sidewalk and just generally being very destructive and very frightening. And they came toward Mickey, and it was like a Rambo movie. He was a first-class boxer and a hard hitter. A lot of welterweights couldn't hit very much. He could. And it went in his space. It was like a blinding flash of maybe under 2 minutes. He had the six of them laid out on the ground or in this gutter or in doorways. It was an absolute disaster for them. And Mickey could not buy anything in that neighborhood again for so long as he lived there.
Nat Hentoff is my guest, and he's just written a new memoir. It's titled Boston Boy. When you went to college, you went to Northwestern University. You went to Northeastern University, which is in Chicago.
No. Northwestern is in Chicago.
Oh.
And it's in Evanston, really. And Northeastern is a largely unknown but now huge university in Boston. When I went there, it was not huge at all. It was and still is a working-class university. That is, most of the people who go there come from working-class families. When I was there, practically all of them were the first in their families to go to college, and I think there's a pretty good percentage of that now. It was the first university in the country, I think, to do an extensive amount of work on co-op systems. That is, I didn't do this, but most of the kids did. You go to work for 13 weeks in a field aligned to what you're studying, and you get paid for it. And then you go back to school for 13 weeks. So it's a very no-nonsense school. It has none of the cachet of Harvard or even Tufts, but it's not a bad place.
How significant was it to you to be the first one in the family to go to college?
So far as I thought about it, so far as I can remember myself thinking about it, it was sort of so foreordained that there wasn't anything special about it. It was known that every Jewish kid in that neighborhood, one way or another, would go to some college or other, because we are the people of the book, and in the old country where most of our parents came from, It was difficult to get into college, certainly into a secular school, because they didn't like Jews, to say the least. But once we were here, and I think that this is largely among Asians these days. Certainly the Chinese kids, I think by the time they're five, must know that they're going to college and do graduate work.
You got interested in jazz at a pretty young age. What was your first attraction to it, and what really spoke to you about the music
when
you heard it?
It goes back to when I was much younger than when I started being interested in jazz. We had to go to the synagogue from the time we could walk, not all the time, but for the holiest of, the Rosh Hashanah, New Year's, Yom Kippur. And I was just struck by the singing, the cantor, the chazan. He's an improviser. It's really like Jewish blues. And it's usually a man who is a considerable virtuoso as a performer, who is basing his work on centuries-old traditions of liturgical music, but has to tell his own story, like a jazz musician. Otherwise, it doesn't work. And the music is, in turn, defiant, ecstatic, lyrical, terribly sad, joyous. It's powerful stuff. And I didn't hear anything like that, aside from the synagogue, until I was about 11 years old, walking down Washington Street, which is the main business street of Boston, or was then, and coming out of the public address system of a record store, why, it sounded like 15 chazans, except they were all playing instruments. They weren't singing. Chazan on a trombone, a chazan on a trumpet. And it turned out to be, I wish I could say, in tribute to my taste at the time, that this was a Duke Ellington's band or Count Basie's band, but no, it was Artie Shaw's Nightmare. Which is okay, because I always thought Artie Shaw was underrated. And I rushed in. I had to know what the record was. And I bought the record, even though I didn't have a record player. I didn't want it to let it get away from me.
You took clarinet lessons when you were young. Did you want to be a jazz musician?
I had the notion that I could read anything. That's why my teacher, who was an alumnus of the Boston Symphony, suggested that there might be a small chance I could get in if I wanted to. But I didn't like that idea at all. Who wants to spend his life playing other people's music? But I was disabused of any possibility that I could be a decent jazz musician when I was about 14 years old. I was practicing the clarinet by an open window, and I heard a crude, curt shout from below, "Hey, kid!" And I looked down, and there was a very short person of about 12 years old. "You want to go to a session?" Apparently he was missing a clarinet player. So I went to this session. And I could read the charts, pretty much. I could not improvise. This guy, this 12-year-old difficult person, as he has been all of his life since, picked up his horn, and it was the most beautiful, lyrical, flowing, totally improvised music I had heard outside of Louis Armstrong and the real, you know, classics. His name was Ruby Braff. Now, Ruby taught me right away that I wasn't going to be a jazz musician.
Once you figured out you weren't going to really be a jazz musician, was that it? Did you give up playing if you couldn't be that good?
Pretty much. Yeah. I did like everything else in my life was head, studying, reading, which is fine. I like that. But there was something nicely tactile about being able to move around the keys and to make these sounds, which really weren't so bad in terms of classical music anyway.
You've written about how you could always go up to a baseball player or a movie star and ask for an autograph, but if a jazz musician walked by, you were just you're just awestruck and you were speechless. What was different to you about jazz musicians than other famous people or important people?
What they did, that is the sounds that came out of their horns, were so full of life that they seemed to me to be larger than life. That is, the other adults I knew, family members, even my father, teachers, which that's about limits the amount of adults you know when you're a kid, were just okay. You know, they were sort of medium-sized figures so far as the life force was concerned. But to hear Ben Webster I remember I had a chance to meet Johnny Hodges backstage at a theater, and I couldn't open my mouth. I mean, it was like a deity that he could make this kind of sound. Now, in time, as I began to write about them, I really had to stop that and talk to them. And sure, they have as many differences of integrity and decency as anybody else. But I still find them, I'm somewhat in awe of them. I cover, and I have covered for years, all kinds of people, politicians, people in education, civil liberties lawyers and defendants. I'd still rather be, by and large, with jazz people than with anybody else. They're just very live people.
Did you start hanging out in clubs when you were still underage?
Oh, yeah. When I was about 14, fortunately, I had the kind of Richard Nixon beard even then, so that people thought I was older. And I would go to Sunday jam sessions at a place called the Kent Club. And that's where I first heard Sidney Bechet and Wild Bill Davison and people like that. And then once I was in radio at the age of 19, or before that actually, I made my home a place called the Savoy. It was a club just over at Symphony Hall in Boston. There's a bridge maybe a half a block after that, and it is sort of the dividing line between the black section of town and the white section of town. And the Savoy was just over that bridge. And that's where I heard, that's where I learned so much about music and more to the point, talking to the musicians between sets, after hours.
You actually became very friendly with a lot of musicians,
Yeah.
Especially like before you were professionally writing
about
music.
Well, some of them, like Rex Stewart and Ben Webster, and to some extent Duke Ellington, sort of took me on as a foster son. That is, I was obviously interested. I was obviously terribly impressed by them. And they took the time, and I was very grateful for that, to talk to me not only about music but other things as well. I mean, after all, these are people who had traveled not only all over the United States but all over Europe. And being outsiders anywhere, including the United States because they were black, they were very trenchant observers. And to hear Rex Stewart talk politics was really to listen to an expert in that, much, much sharper, I must say, than Walter Lippmann, whom I was reading at the time.
Did you go through a period of wanting to be black because so many of your idols were black and were part of a culture that you could be friends with them, but you couldn't really be part of it by virtue of being white and by virtue of not being a musician?
There might have been a glancing fantasy toward that end when I was quite young. But on the other hand, and the jazz world at the time, this is in the 40s, was one of the very few places in America where this could happen. There were white people who were a part of that world, not as fully as black jazz musicians, but people like Pee Wee Russell, Jack Teagarden, in his way, Art Hodes. So I'm not much for, I mean, I like fantasizing, and I do it as, you know, in terms of the fiction I write, but in the rest of the world, or my life in the world, I don't spend much time with it. And it seemed to me that I could only be myself, and myself was not black, but I could at least try to figure out what was going on and ask these guys to teach me more.
When you started writing about jazz as a journalist and as a critic, was it hard to write about people who you already felt such admiration for? You were in awe of them, you'd become friends with some of them.
Yeah.
But suddenly you were in a different position. You were reporting on them and you were reviewing their work. Was it a difficult transition?
It was only difficult when I didn't like their work.
Well, I'd imagine that would be terrible.
Yeah, I never had that problem with Duke because I just never found anything by Duke that wasn't very interesting, although there were gradations. The one time where that turned out to be most unfortunate, the problem one has as a critic when you're reviewing something by a friend, the smartest thing, of course, is to not review it. I wasn't smart. Paul Desmond was my closest friend. He was the alto saxophonist with Dave Brubeck. He was the guy who brought some some music to that otherwise clanging old railroad car that was called the Dave Brubeck Quartet. And Paul and I really were very close. We had the same tastes and obsessions. And he put out a record once. I was doing practically all the jazz record reviewing at the time for Downbeat, and it was just not a good record. It was really, I don't know who talked him into it, but it was sort of like Good Housekeeping jazz, the kind of jazz that anybody would like and not remember. And I thought about it, and I said, I can't lie about it because that's not fair to the people who use these reviews to buy records. What I should have done is to give it to somebody else. What I did do was to give it the same treatment I would give a record by anybody else who made that kind of record, and I slammed it. And that was the end of the friendship. And I regret that very much.
Did that kind of problem persist where it was hard to write critically about someone whose work you basically admired and who you felt some friendship with?
No, I never. The other times that came up, the other musicians would be ironic and sardonic, but it never ended the friendship. Like Horace Silver once said to me, "So I'm an angular pianist, huh? Would you play that for me?"
Did anyone ever say, "Well, if you don't have anything nice to say, you shouldn't say it"?
Oh, that's many musicians feel that. Many writers feel that. Many painters feel that. It's, I think, probably the most commonplace thing that critics hear, that you're in business as a critic to help the art form. And you can't possibly help the art form by denigrating anybody who practices it. Well, that's like saying, after all, the common art form for all of us is constitutional democracy. And you can't knock anybody who's practicing it, let's say like Ronald Reagan, who is doing it great harm every day, without it. I mean, it's just crazy. If you're a critic, you have to hit it, you know, where it is. But I don't think you ought to review records by your friends.
I think that some artists, too, think of critics as being parasites. That they don't make the art, they just write about it and criticize
that's
it.
That's one of the reasons I was delighted to finally stop being a critic. I had some of that feeling.
You felt that way?
Yeah. I was proud of not the record reviews or the performance reviews, because some of those were tough and probably cost somebody some jobs. And even though I felt I was listening with as much objectivity as impossible there, but with as much, let's say, informed subjectivity as possible, I didn't feel good about it. I did feel very good about the long interviews I did with Lester Young, with Duke, with a whole lot of people, because they've now become, some of them, part of history. And that wasn't the critic, that was the, if you like, it sounds pompous, the historian. And you get these people down in terms of what they want to remember and how they remember it before it's too late. When I finally stopped being a full-time critic, I still kept writing about music, but ever since, and that's been many years now, I do not review records I don't like. I no longer have the responsibility to have to review the Spectrum. So when I write for the Wall Street Journal or the Progressive, I only write about records I'm trying to convince other people to get. And it's a much better feeling. Makes life more pleasant with my daughter, too, because she's a professional musician. And she used to say, "How dare you? How dare you say this about somebody when you can't even tell a C chord from a I don't know what?" And I would say musicians can be lousy critics, too. It's not that, that's not the question. But anyway, I'm much more comfortable not getting in the way of other people's living.
But that was an interesting point your daughter raised, because you never wrote C chord kind of criticism anyways.
No.
I mean, you didn't approach it from
but I got a, good
a
lesson.
Technical
I got a good
view.
Lesson once. Gunther Schiller and I used to do a series for public radio at the time. And he thought that Oscar Peterson was the most extraordinary pianist that had ever been in any form of music. And I thought, well, I'll tell you what I thought in terms of a story Duke Ellington figures in. Marion McPartland, another pianist, had been in the United States only 6 months, and she was playing at a place in New York called the Hickory Club, Hickory House. And that was the place where Duke, one of the few nights when he was off the road, would come in and have dinner. And he heard her first set, and she came off the stand, and Duke gave her his characteristic large smile and said, my. You play so many notes. And Marion said, 6 months went by before I realized, because I was green as grass, that he was saying, all you play is notes. There is no music there. Now, Peterson, to me, is a perfect example of this, except rare occasions. He is all over the keyboard. He can do anything, so he never bothers to leave anything out, by contrast, let's say, with Count Basie. But Schiller was saying that because he's a musician with fine ears in terms of technique, that this was a great musician. I knew better. Even though I couldn't tell a C chord from a I don't know what, I knew better.
So you think musicians are sometimes overly impressed with technique.
That's right, yeah.
And that people who aren't musicians but understand the other parts of music won't be as easily
One thing that made me
deceived.
Feel very good, years ago I was walking down the street and I ran across Gil Evans. And I was brooding about this. I think my daughter had given me a lecture or something. And I said, you know, Gil, I shouldn't even be in this thing at all. He said, that's nonsense. That's nonsense. First of all, people, after a period of time, judge you and pay attention to you on the basis of whether you've led them astray or not in the past. But most importantly, it doesn't matter what you know technically. If you know how to listen and can write about that, then that can be useful. So
a jazz critic friend of mine who I was talking to credits you with really helping to change jazz criticism from a form in which people wrote about musicians as colorful old codgers to actually treating music jazz criticism as an form of art criticism, and to writing about issues that faced black musicians performing in America. What was the state of jazz criticism when you started writing?
Well, when I started, most of it was impressionistic, not written for the most part by musicians. Robert Goffin, a Belgian, I think had written the first book way back in the 1919-1920. Hughes Panassier, a French, a polemical French critic, also was a largely impressionistic. I don't mean to put down that whole approach, because I read a book called Jazz Men, which has, thank goodness, been reissued, about a year ago by Limelight. It's a publisher in New York, puts out paperback books on the performing arts. That book was edited by Charles Edward Smith and Fred Ramsey, and consisted of essays on the whole New Orleans context, Bix Beiderbecke, and it was marvelously romantic. There wasn't a G chord in it, but it was full of history as well. And most of all, and this is something that writing on music or any form of art should most want you to most accomplish, it made you so... You were frustrated by every second that went by between the time you read the passage in the book and the time you could get the record it talked about or the musician it talked about. It made you want to hear. That's powerful stuff. Very few critics can do that. I didn't realize anybody thought I contributed anything novel to the craft. If I did anything, I think it was, I don't know about criticism as an art form, but I probably did do more than most people at the time to indicate that the music was talking about lives, and the musicians would tell you that if you asked them, so that being black in America, many of them had political points of view that came through the music, all that was relevant to discussing the music. It didn't make the music. I mean, if the music was terrible, it didn't matter how noble the political ideology was. But in terms of what the forces were that created the music, it was useful to know all that.
When you said that a lot of the music criticism was impressionistic, you mean string of adjectives, how it felt, and
the way Walter Damrosch used to write in terms of classical music, there was nothing to hold on to after it was all done.
Mm-hmm. You eventually started producing records as well, and you've produced records by Charles Mingus, mm-hmm, and Cecil Taylor, Pee Wee Russell, just to name a few. Did that put you in an uncomfortable situation? And what I'm thinking is that a lot of jazz musicians have become so accustomed to being treated badly and to being ripped off financially from record companies that they might have been suspicious of you in that record producer capacity. Did it put you in an uncomfortable
position? No, because we had a setup under Archie Blyer. Archie was the guy who ran Cadence Records and had a lot of hits at the time. And I ran the jazz label, which was called Candid, with Bob Altshuler, who was an old-time jazz aficionado, who is now a vice president at Columbia Records. He was well-known to the musicians, too. And our you know, there was no attempt to, here's the contract, take it to your lawyer before you sign it, that sort of stuff. In fact, Max Roach once brought up his own lawyer, who was a very militant fellow, who's now a civil judge in New York, Bruce Wright, a very good judge. And Bruce was astonished because he couldn't think of anything to make the terms better. No, I didn't have any problem with that. You know why? Because I knew I was straight. And if you know that, there's no problem. But I enjoyed that experience a lot because, first of all, I was giving work to musicians. And more personally, that's a record collector's dream, to be able to say, I want this fellow, this fellow, this fellow. Let's all go into the studio and play. It wasn't at all, and it was the least difficult job I've ever had, because once I had asked a leader to take over, he was the leader. And I had nothing to do really except order sandwiches and keep time on the various takes. Once in a great while, it always happens, or it doesn't always happen, but often happens, they'd get stuck on a number. They just couldn't make it work. So then my job would be, and this is hardly profound A&R work, but it was pretty effective, I'd go down and say to the leader, Well, why don't we play a blues? And that always worked. Never failed.
Were there any conflicts for you during the early period of black nationalism, when there was a strong separatist feeling among I think, a lot of blacks who were involved with that, as many jazz musicians were at the time?
Obviously, I felt the heat. I expected to feel the heat. I was very much interested in what was going on at the time. That's how I got to know Malcolm, long before he was known in the white press at all. And there's no way to, it seems to, I wasn't going to argue with him. There was no way to deal with that verbally. After a period of time, in most cases, whatever that wall was began to dissolve to some extent. But I didn't feel personally hurt or anything like that. I figured this was a part of a transitional part to some extent. I'm not counting the such present-day practitioners as Farrakhan. It was understandable. I had some analogous sense of that in terms of my own neighborhood. My mother, she didn't trust Gentiles. Blacks didn't trust whites. I understood where both of them were coming from. And again, all I could do was be myself.
My guest is Nat Hentoff, and he's just written a memoir. It's titled Boston Boy, and it's published by Knopf. Well, we've talked a little bit about some of your work with jazz, and you've also written about so many other subjects, but a subject that I think of you as writing about persistently is civil liberties, First Amendment issues. How did you start to take on the role of being a defender of the First Amendment and of civil liberties?
Well, the First Amendment obsession was rooted in an incident that really was not technically a First Amendment matter. I was the editor of my college paper at Northeastern, and we were a pretty good bunch of muckrakers, and we did things that made the Board of Trustees, members of the Board of Trustees, especially the president, very, very angry. And when we started to research a series that would have included each member of the Board of Trustees, and we were going to ask him, aside from the fact that you get enough bread to be on the board, what makes you think you know enough about education to help set policy? Well, that did it. And we were forced to resign, wasn't the word, to leave the paper. And that got me very interested, really for the first time. It was very personal, I must say. It wasn't ideological, in freedom of the press. And I sort of became sensitive to that in all kinds of other areas as time went on. And then, obviously, when I became a journalist, any journalist who doesn't take the First Amendment seriously, at least that part of it that says of the press, is not paying attention. And as more and more problems arose from libel to the high school press and the various problems high school kids have with their principals and superintendents, et cetera, it just became as natural an extension of my interest as jazz is.
Have you had any crises of conscience during the period that you've been writing about civil liberties where you had to face a difficult decision and weren't really sure what the right way to behave was, and you had to really weigh for yourself what the consequences would be of the decision that you finally made?
The only thing I can think of that was really intense was what I wrote about in the book, and I wasn't even a journalist then. I was about to leave Boston. I had been on, well, I guess I was a journalist of sorts because I've been a stringer for Downbeat and I'd done freelance writing and the like. Anyway, I had taught at a place called the Samuel Adams School, which I knew perfectly well at the time was a communist front operation. I mean, if you knew anything about politics, and I grew up in a neighborhood where everybody knew everything about politics, you would recognize certain names. And you'd say, okay, now you know where that is. But I decided to teach there anyway because I wanted to teach jazz. I mean, it was the only school in all of Boston that would allow that. And I didn't think about it again until the Massachusetts Committee Against Subversives, or whatever it was called, began to make headlines and began to investigate all kinds of people for all kinds of all the usual reasons, associations, books they'd written, that sort of thing. And I was about to leave Boston because I'd finally been given a chance to be New York editor of Downbeat. And I began a debate within myself, should I go see the senator who was in charge of this committee and tell him what he probably already knows? I gave them more credit for being assiduous investigators of people's past than they were, at least in my case. Should I tell him that and get it over with and then not have to be hauled back on by subpoena from New York to Boston again? So I decided to go see him. He was quite surprised to see me. He didn't know why I was there at first. And I just said I wanted to make sure, I wanted to clarify if that were necessary, what you have in the dossier, et cetera. And he said, oh, yeah, the Samuel Adams School. He said, well, can you name anybody else who was there? And that's when I did a very bad thing. I only named several names that were in the catalog and that were in the ads and the newspapers. But of course, I shouldn't have given them the satisfaction of naming any names at all. But I did, and the whole thing was a kind of a sour farce, because on thinking upon it, I doubt if they ever would subpoena me, because I wasn't important enough to subpoena. Nobody knew my name, so to speak. Well, that's not entirely true. I'd been in radio. But anyway, that's irrelevant. And this is kind of ex post facto rationalization for a thing I wish I hadn't done. It did give me more empathy than I think I would have had with those people who name names. It's easy to be, if you've never done it, if you've never been tempted to do it, it's easy to be very righteous. But some people were under real pressures. I wasn't. I mean, I have no exculpation for what I did. But people with families, jobs, relatives, God knows what, I know some of those stories. And in that respect, I suppose it was a good thing that I did it. But if I had to do it over again, I wouldn't do it.
You've written a lot against censorship.
Mm-hmm.
Have any of your books been censored?
Only, so far as I know, several of the books I write for young adults, young readers. They're not. It turns out they're not young adults often. Kids read, when they read, much at a much higher level earlier than they did when I was a kid. Anyway, the book that seems to have been most popular in recent years among kids is a book called This School is Driving Me Crazy. And it's about an elementary school boy named Sam who gets into a lot of trouble from the time he gets up in the morning. And I didn't intend this book to be anything other than a story, but over a period of months, a number of reading teachers around the country told me that the book had been very useful to them in teaching kids, especially boys, with reading difficulties. I suppose because they could identify with this kid who was always in trouble. And then I began hearing from reading teachers saying, oh, I'm sorry to tell you this, but the book's been withdrawn. And it was censored in several schools, especially in Alabama. And I found out the reason was damn, hell. I'm not going to get into any of the seven dirty words Justice Stevens.
Or else we'll have to
but those aren't among
do
them.
Something here, right?
And the other one, which is also not on his list, mm-hmm. George Carlin's list, was Limp Dick. There's a couple of kids were talking in the schoolyard. And I got so annoyed. It was the only time I've felt that if I had the chance to do it over again, I would have censored myself, because it was so stupid to withdraw the book on that basis and to deprive kids who might be helped by it. I finally called up. I tracked down the name of one of the schools in Alabama, and I called up the principal. And a very amiable man, he said, well, I will tell you, we went through the review process, and the review committee, various teachers and the librarians, thought we ought to keep the book. But I overruled them. I said, why? Because two parents had complained. And I got another insight. Adversity, however mild, gives you some insight into the whole process of courage by which most principals do their job.
My guest is Nat Hentoff. Some of the issues that you face as a child, you've since faced as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking of things like how to bring up children, bringing them up within or outside of religion. You really rebelled against the Jewish religion when you were growing up. And you tell a story about eating a salami sandwich outside of the synagogue on Yom Kippur, which is the day Jews are supposed to be fasting.
Only a rotten kid would do that.
Did you want to bring up your children inside of religion? And I'm thinking here that some parents who are not religious themselves want to give their children some religion so that their children will have a choice and that they'll feel that they've been a part of it and that they're free to reject it and rebel against it or accept it.
No, I couldn't in any kind of honesty, and my kids are very quick and voluble in detecting dishonesty, especially in their parents. I couldn't in any honesty try to bring them up in the Jewish religion or any religion. They know I'm an atheist. They know my wife is an atheist. But what I did want, and this is very difficult to do if you don't give them the structure of some kind of religious, not so much faith, even ritual, is to try to get them to understand that they were Jewish in terms of Jewish culture, in terms of history, so that they would feel identified as Jewish. I think that has worked in maybe three out of the four of them, because just because of what they hear and see and read. And something, for example, as popular in the pejorative sense that many people use the word popular, as The House of Rothschild, the musical, and Fiddler on the Roof, the movie, turned my oldest son, who was the most stubborn of all the kids, the most rebellious, into insisting when he was just short of 13 that he had to be bar mitzvahed. It had never occurred to my wife or to me to ask him to be bar mitzvah because, again, we don't have the religious thrust. He insisted on it because he had seen the House of Rothschild and had seen Fiddler on the Roof, and damn it, he was going to become part of the Jewish community officially. And we got a tutor. He learned how to sing. He learned Hebrew. He did a very, very impressive job, I must say. With my daughters, they feel Jewish, I know, not only because they knew enough. They were old enough to know about Lenny Bruce, and they saw Lenny, and Lenny is really one of the, I think, key characters of Yiddish culture in our time. But, for example, my older daughter, who's a circus performer, tells stories. There aren't many Jews in the circus. So she feels to be an outsider, it just happens. And the story she tells is she was with a troupe, and most of the members of the troupe are from European families who have been circus performers for generations. None of them Jewish. And a very old lady said to her late one night, I was about to say around the campfire, Jessica, you're Jewish. Yeah. And you're with the circus? Yeah. I thought all Jews were smart. So she has the sense, her kind of way, and so does my daughter, the jazz musician. It's a chancy thing to do, though. But I don't know any other way to do it if you don't have the religion yourself. I do want them to feel Jewish, but I can't insist, obviously.
Is it a contradiction to, on the one hand, be an atheist and, on the other hand, think it's so important to feel Jewish and to have your children feel Jewish?
Not for me, because the neighborhood I grew up in had a lot of, although, you know, all the synagogues were Orthodox, had a lot of atheists. There were a lot of people very involved in politics. The FDR Democrats were really the conservatives. So I was exposed to a lot of Trotskyites, different kinds of socialists, communists, etc., all of whom practically were atheists, but all of whom came to where they were from a sense that Jewish meant social justice. And I remember my father would say when somebody had done something, an employer to his workers or the president of the United States had done something really indecent, my father would say, that's not Jewish. And to me, Jewish meant to be just, to be fair to people. And I know that's where I got, you know, that impetus toward whatever I do now in civil liberties and politics.
So it's a secular form of Judaism feel a part of.
Sure. You know, just there are Catholics who are not all that Catholic in terms of the going to church or to Mass, etc., but who identify very strongly with what the National Conference of Catholic Bishops is doing in terms of against nuclear buildup, against the president's policy in Central America. There is a very strong strain of liberal Catholicism.
You have been outspoken against some of Israel's foreign policy, and particularly outspoken against Israel's invasion of Lebanon a few years ago. And the group of fringe rabbis excommunicated you, which doesn't really happen in the Jewish religion.
No, they have no authority
But I'm wondering what that experience has been like for you. The Jewish community is very divided over Israel, and when someone speaks out against it, they are frequently going to be criticized by other Jews for...
I was criticized more strongly than for anything else I've ever done, except when I became all of a sudden pro-life in terms of the abortion issue. But I don't think the criticism of the invasion of... My criticism of the Israel invasion of Lebanon would be nearly so strong now because... What I predicted, and I'm a very minor figure in all this, but what Abba Iban was predicting on the floor of the Knesset day after day, saying things much harsher than I was saying, that this would divide Israel as nothing before it ever done, that this would injure the morale in the army, which it has done, that this would lead to untold number of Israeli deaths for no good reason, and that this would eventually enhance, as it turned out, to the forces of in Israel that are really against any kind of constitutional, not because they don't have a constitution, but any kinds of civil liberties. I mean, Meir Kahane, he has grown because of the divisions over the invasion. I think more Jews realize now that if you want to help Israel become more of what it is intended to be, what Zionism is about, you don't help it by being quiet when it's wrong. And that's the lesson I hope that was learned then. A lot of people in the major Jewish organizations were very hostile to what Begin was doing and what Sharon was doing. They wouldn't speak out. I don't know if they'd speak out now, but I hope so.
Do you think that that's a fear of breaking ranks, not unlike the fear that you described your parents of having, that you don't go outside of your community, and the implication, too, is that you don't criticize the people within it in a way that the outsiders would hear?
Well, I think there's a very conscious historical belief that if Jews, who are always in the minority and therefore always potentially vulnerable, if they start to argue among themselves in public, then the Gentiles will know that they're not united, will take advantage of that lack of unity, and more specifically, and this is the main point that AIPAC always comes out with, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, that their support in Congress will be weakened because the members of Congress will say, why should we put in this huge appropriation for Israel when, look, there are Jews here and Jews there who don't agree with the Israeli government on this or that thing?
My guess is Nat Hentoff. You raised your children in the city and your sons were raised in the city. And
also my daughters.
And you intentionally wanted to do that. You didn't want to bring them up in the country, in the suburbs. You wanted them exposed to the pluralism of city life.
This is a very prejudiced thing to say, but my sense of kids who come out of the suburbs, and obviously there are many exceptions, but I've been in a lot of suburban schools because I write about education, is that they tend to lack what in Yiddish is the word tam, flavor. They tend to be rather bland. Kids who grow up in the city, because of all the stimuli, good and bad, dangerous and benign, tend to be not only sharper in terms of, they know their way around, not only in terms of the streets, but in terms of bookstores and things like that. They're just exposed to much more, and I think they grow up more. I'm not saying they grow up better. Some of them wind up being very prejudiced, indeed, because of their experiences in the city. But they do grow up having been stretched. Their intelligence, their sensibilities, such as they are stretched because of all. I mean, I tried to write once in the suburbs, and I couldn't see anybody on the streets from 8 in the morning till 6 at night. And I felt numbed. It's a very strange world out there. It's not a city world, obviously.
You live in Manhattan?
Yeah, in Greenwich Village.
Were you ever worried, about exposing your children to a more paranoid lifestyle, having them grow up in Manhattan than they'd be exposed to, say, in the suburbs where they have perhaps a greater sense of security and safety?
There's no question that the physical security, I would think, absent the aberrant incidents, would be greater in the suburbs. All of my kids have been subject to experiences, to trauma, if you like, of varying degrees in the city. And I don't for one second say that did them any good. Quite the opposite. I wish it hadn't happened. All I will say about it is that they survived it. And they survived it, I think, with a lot of resiliency. I always felt that the best thing I ever read about parenting was in William O. Douglas's, I think, the first volume of his autobiography. He had two children. And he said that I would consider myself to have been a capable parent if I could take my two children up in an airplane and go to some remote place and leave them there, and they would survive. There is something analogous to that about growing up in the city.
Some of the advice that you were given when you were young was to not mingle with people who weren't like you. Did you ever give your children advice one way or another on that subject?
They never needed it because all through their lives, at least once they could walk, their friends were of so many different kinds of backgrounds and colors and all that.
You, at some point, I don't know when, requested your Freedom of Information Act files from the FBI. You reprint just a couple of lines from that in your memoir, and I got the feeling that you could probably learn more about your genealogy from the information you got in the files.
I had forgotten that they had, I hadn't looked when I was researching the book, using that term rather loosely. I just forgot about that, and I'm trying to find out where on earth my father had been born and where my mother had been born. We didn't have the papers. My relatives didn't know. And then I was looking over the FBI files, and they knew. More than that, and this is, I think, astonishing, my second job when I was 11 years old was in a haberdashery. I couldn't remember the man's name. And I looked in the files. They knew the man's name. I really should have dedicated the book in part to the FBI.
What surprised you, besides that kind of interesting detail, what surprised you about what they had been following about you and why?
Well, they had the usual kind of stuff. They had copies of some of my articles. They had anti-war ads and pro-civil rights ads I had signed. The only thing that surprised me, most of it was a waste of the taxpayers' money, was one of the FBI agents took it upon himself to be a literary critic. And there was a piece I'd had in Playboy in which I talked about dissent and what the FBI was doing to violate the rights of dissent. And the agent affixed the notes to the director saying, a very poorly written piece. I thought that was a bit beyond his competence.
Once you found out that there was a file on you, did it change the way you behaved at all? Did you look over your shoulder, so to speak, and always think that somebody was monitoring you?
No, I had a lot of fun with the FBI. They came to visit me several times. The most serious occasion was when, I forget the date, but a group of people who fortunately have never become identified raided the FBI office after hours in Media, Pennsylvania, and took away a huge number of papers. And they were the first papers, they were of great use to various congressional committees too, that began to demystify and to illuminate how the FBI operated in terms of surveillance, whom they went after, et cetera. So the agents came to me and they wanted to know where these papers were. As a matter of fact, they were right at my feet. I keep a very terrible office. And I had all I could do to avoid looking at them, and I sent them swiftly on their way. I said, go see my lawyer at the ACLU. Then I wrote about it, making fun of them. And I had written about them twice before, making fun of them. And I found out years later, then I never heard from the FBI again, and I found out years later that Hoover had a short list of people who, and agents were instructed never to visit them because they always wrote about it and made a joke of the Bureau. I don't think Mr. Webster operates the same way now, but we'll see.
You've been writing for the Village Voice since, I think it's 1958?
That's right.
What's kept you there that long?
Freedom. I've had all kinds of hassles with various editors from time to time. That's natural to being a writer. But nobody's ever told me what to write or what not to write. And I have the great luxury that any columnist has, but more so in The Voice, I don't have to check with anybody as to what I want to do. And more to the point, for me, if I get obsessed with a topic, as I did with Abscam and what the FBI was doing to the Fourth Amendment, or the Baby Doe situation where the whole of the press was saying that these parents and doctors were right, go ahead and kill the kids, as if the kids were not persons under the Constitution with due process rights of their own, I can do 20, 25, 30 columns if I want to.
What stage do you see the Voice being in now? What stage do you think it is in its own development?
It's lucky. It has no real competition. There are now only three newspapers in New York, and one could take a bet that, or one could argue that the New York Post really isn't a newspaper. So The Voice fills a gap. It does very well in terms of classified ads, entertainment listings, personals. I sometimes wonder if it wouldn't sell just as well if there were no editorial matter in it at all. Well, that's not quite true. But we don't, we have to, I think, and this drives everybody up top crazy when I say this, I think we have too many orthodoxies. You will not find articles in there except when I'm writing on the other side of the abortion thing. You will not find any articles critical of the homosexual community. You will not find any articles supportive of Edward Koch. It's hard to do, but it's possible. And as a result, we don't have that unpredictability that we had in the past. You could get staff writers arguing with each other from 18 different ways on the same subject. That simply doesn't happen anymore.
There's still a lot of argument, though, between the writers.
Yeah, and that's silly. I mean, I've engaged in it, but it's not on issues. It's personal, and who cares?
You've just written your first book in what I think is going to be a series of memoirs. You do plan on writing more?
There'll certainly be a second one. Whether that turns out to be a third, I don't know yet.
What has it been like for you to look back on yourself and, in a way, judge yourself? Because I think you have to do that.
Oh, sure.
Do you like the person that you just wrote about, the young Nat Hentoff?
I would change some of the things about him if I could. To me, the most painful thing in the book, even worse than going to the Un-American Activities Committee, was when my mother came cross town. I had finally left home. The first morning after I left home, had my own pad. And the I opened the door, and there she is at 7 or 8 in the morning. And all the way across town on the trolley, she had brought a plate of what else? Chicken soup. And what I did was to slam the door in her face. I did it because I knew a break had to be made or else she'd be on that trolley every other day. But that was a hell of a way to do it. There ought to, I don't know what it was, but there should have been a better way to make that break. So I would have changed that. Otherwise, except for, you know, some things here and there, I guess what I really, I mean, Norman Lear wrote me a letter, which was rather surprising. He said, I envy you the life you had as a kid. And I hadn't thought of it in that way until I began to write this book. And it's true, not many kids get to know and really be friends with Ben Webster or Pee Wee Russell or people like that, or get to work when they're 15 under the fearless Frances Sweeney and see how the exaltation she takes in being a muckraker. So I guess what I found out that I hadn't really thought about before was it was a pretty good life.
Well, I'm glad you wrote about it, and I want to thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
My guest has been Nat Hentoff, and the first in what will probably be a series of memoirs is called Boston Boy, and it's published by Knopf. It's about the early years of his life. Nat Hentoff has written extensively about jazz and about civil liberties. He has a regular column in the Village Voice, and he's written for really just about all the jazz magazines, has produced some jazz records, and also has novels and I think books of nonfiction as well for children.
Yeah, a couple of them.
Yeah. Well, thank you again for being with us. It's really been terrific to meet you.
Well, I appreciate it.
It's a minute and a half to 5. All Things Considered is coming up at 5 from National Public Radio. I'll tell you what's happening later this week on Fresh Air, but first let's check in with Shadow Traffic.
Well, thank you very much, and good afternoon. First off, westbound Schuylkill Expressway, a 15-minute ride between the Roosevelt Boulevard and City Avenue. Also jammed on the outbound Kelly Drive as you make your way up around the Strawberry Mansion Bridge. An earlier accident now cleared. An accident just cleared for the West River Drive, and traffic slow there between the Sweetbriar Cutoff and Black Road. Traveling in Havertown, some construction on Westchester Pike and Eagle Road. Traffic jam there. In Philadelphia, an accident at 53rd and Master. That's Shadow Traffic. I'm John Butterworth on 91 FM, WHYY.
And coming up in just 1 minute, we'll join National Public Radio for All Things Considered. That Shadow Traffic Report was funded by Wilkie Buick. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, we'll be joined by Reverend Paul Washington, who's the minister of the Church of the Advocate in North Philadelphia, who's just received the Philadelphia Award for his many years of work in the community. And at 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by the Philadelphia Inquirer's new film critic, Carrie Rickey. This Friday at 3 o'clock, we'll be joined by cartoonist and filmmaker Ken Brown. And at 4 o'clock, we're going to have a live studio concert with rhythm guitarist Marty Gross and clarinetist and soprano saxophonist Dick Meldonian. So that's live this Friday at 4 o'clock. There's still a few seats left. If you'd like to join us, call in advance at 351-9200 and make a reservation. That's about it for today's program. Ron Barron and Joyce Lieberman were the engineers. Production assistants from Millie Moffitt. Amy Salad is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I are the producers of Fresh Air. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening, and I hope you have a terrific evening. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. This is Noah Adams.
And I'm Wendy Kaufman with All Things Considered.
There is no overpricing today to make up for past underpricing. Increases today are needed simply to bring insurance prices in line with the costs of policies written today.
An insurance industry spokesman answering one of the charges made by those who believe the underwriting companies are to blame for the so-called liability insurance crisis. The story tonight in All Things Considered.
Also, several foreign journalists forced to leave Libya and reports of a new Libyan government with Muammar Gaddafi in a power-sharing role.
In South Africa, the government does away with many of the laws restricting the movements of blacks.
The Supreme Court takes up the constitutionality of the Graham-Rudman budget balancing law.
And Shakespeare in China. First, this news.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. A pro-Libyan group in Lebanon says it has kidnapped British journalist Alec Collett and sent a videotape of what it called his hanging to a Beirut newspaper. The tape shows a man wearing a black eye mask hanging from a scaffold. The man is said to resemble Collett, but it is impossible to make a positive identification. Reporter Nora Bustani in Beirut says the Revolutionary Organization of Socialist Muslims said Collett had been hanged last week when three other hostages were found murdered.
Britain's Philip Padfield and Lee Douglas and that of American hostage Peter Kilbourne were discovered, a statement was issued claiming that Collett had been executed by hanging and promising that a picture of the what they called hanging ceremony would be sent to An-Nahar.
Nora Bustani reports for The Washington Post. She says a statement released with the videotape claims Collett was killed in revenge for the U.S. raid on Libya. The government of Libya today told all foreign journalists they must leave the country, but denied they were being expelled because 21 Libyans have been ordered out of Britain. Libya's information minister said the reporters must leave by Friday because there would be no more tours, the only way journalists were allowed to report from Libya, and because the hotel space they are using is needed for a visiting delegation. Some of the estimated 250 journalists left immediately, but others appeared ready to remain in Libya despite the government's request. Libya's information minister claimed today that the United States and Israel have planned terrorist attacks in Europe for which Libya would be blamed. The White House quickly denied any such plans. The minister said he had reports from what he called friendly states, including European countries, that U.S. and Israeli intelligence would stage terrorist operations in Europe to justify a new bombing raid on Libya. President Reagan today urged forceful and collective action to stop terrorism. NPR's Brenda Wilson reports.
In remarks before the United States Chamber of Commerce today, President Reagan devoted most of the time to issues facing the industrial nations at the